In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't. I just ran back into her bedroom, and literally at that point, the curtains, which were closed, just kind of flew open. And that was when I noticed that the window was open as far as it could go and the shutters outside had been raised all the way up. And I just knew straight away that someone had taken her.
Madeline McCann was just 1 week from her fourth birthday when she mysteriously vanished on May 3, 2007, while on holiday in Portugal. Pretty much from the night she disappeared, from the moment her mum Kate screamed out, "They've taken her," Madeline has been the world's most famous missing person. As you just heard, right from the start, Kate and Jerry McCann were insistent that their daughter had been abducted, probably by a pedophile or a human trafficker, in a targeted and sinister attack. They believed someone had been watching their family as they holidayed in the resort town of Praia da Luz. A predator, they said, had been observing the way they left their three young children alone each night while they ate out at a nearby restaurant with friends. And then, on the evening of May 3, in the hours approaching midnight, an intruder seized a tiny window of opportunity, perhaps a window as small as 120 seconds, pounced and stole Madeline while she was sleeping. That's Kate and Jerry McCann's story behind Madeline's disappearance, and ever since then, they have continued to pursue the abduction theory. However, there is another side to that story.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeline McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
I've read enough and I've seen enough to say that there are questions to be asked about the perceived and accepted narrative as to what went on.
That's Colin Sutton, a retired homicide detective with London's Metropolitan Police. Now, over his long crime-fighting career, Colin led more than 30 successful murder investigations. His most notable takedown was Levi Belfield, an English serial killer. Belfield was a real nasty piece of work. He's currently serving multiple life sentences for three murders, including the high-profile abduction and slaying of schoolgirl Millie Dowler in 2002. Millie was just 13 years old when Belfield killed her as she walked home from school in Surrey. I've spoken to Colin a number of times about Maddie. Not only is he an experienced detective, but he's followed this case really closely. He's been to Praia da Luz and spent a great deal of time examining the police files. Colin has been a great source to bounce thoughts and theories off, and during one of our phone conversations, Colin said something that for me, well, it kind of sums up the Maddie mystery in a lot of ways.
The difficulty that I have with it is actually, whichever way you look at it, you've got to kind of believe something that's almost incredible. You've either got to believe that there was a chance abduction of a three-year-old, nearly four-year-old girl from her bedroom in a holiday resort, or you've got to believe that it was a targeted abduction by, you know, an organized gang who took the chance that they were going to have enough time to mount that abduction during a, you know, a window between checks and between adults and parents coming around, that they didn't know how long that window was going to be. It's difficult to think of a sort of professional criminal taking such a chance. Or at the other end, you've got to say that you've got to believe that two parents and their seven friends would be able to concoct a cover story and all stick to that story for 10 years and there never being a chink in it and nobody ever going back on it. So whichever of those kind of choices you look at, you've got to say that each of them has a degree of incredible facts mixed in with it. And you've got to kind of think to yourself that whichever of those it comes down to be in the end, whatever the truth is actually a bit fantastic in this case. It's a, you know, it's a wholly exceptional set of circumstances.
I think Colin is totally right. The Maddie mystery is a wholly exceptional set of circumstances. And it's those circumstances over the next 9 episodes, with the help of people who've worked on the case, people who are close to this case, and experts in associated fields, I examine, test, and in some instances challenge long-held views about how the evidence was interpreted. We also look at the timelines that were given to police and piece together what happened that night. Did Madeline get abducted? A little bit of background. In May 2007, when Maddie vanished, I was living in London. I remember the explosion of media coverage, but at the time, I didn't obsessively follow this story. A couple of months after, I relocated for work. And I guess outside of the UK, where this story was just so huge and all-consuming, I only paid fleeting attention to the headlines of Maddie's story. I was oblivious to the complex layers of detail beneath. And that's really how it stayed for me until a couple of years ago, when I had a conversation that changed everything about the way I looked at Maddie's disappearance. I was speaking with a British friend about a missing persons case in Australia, a young boy named William Tyrrell, around Maddie's age, who had vanished and tragically remains missing. During that conversation, I asked my friend what she thought happened to Madeline. She said in her mind, she thought it was possible that Kate and Jerry knew more than they were letting on. I remember feeling pretty shocked by that. Remember, at this point, I'd really only been a Maddie headline reader. So I asked how and why she'd come to that idea. And my friend, well, she gave two reasons. One, she said that when a small child goes missing or is murdered, it's nearly always at the hand of someone in the family, or close to the family. And two, she thought it was incredibly unlikely for a stranger to break into a holiday apartment and abduct a child in the middle of the night. And that's where this all really started for me. So I went home later that night and I began to research. I researched for hours, past midnight, into the small hours. I came across the Portuguese police files, which have been released to the public, and I began to read witness statements, one of which would later be changed by Jerry McCann. There were timelines that on close examination didn't seem to add up or make sense. And there were cellular phone records which also raised a number of questions. I watched videos of the cadaver dogs in action, searching the McCanns' holiday apartment and the rental car they had hired. The dogs were barking. They seemed to be alerting to something. It was late, but I was wide awake. Missing without a trace is a common phrase in true crime. But to use those words to describe Maddie's disappearance, well, it just wouldn't be right. It'd be inaccurate and misleading, because Maddie did not go missing without a trace. There were traces, there were clues, and there was circumstantial evidence. There was also forensic evidence. And in a later episode, I look at controversial DNA samples with one of the world's leading forensic scientists. The critical fact about these DNA samples is they were swabbed from a car which had been hired by Kate and Jerry McCann 3 weeks after Maddie vanished.
They recovered some DNA from an item, luggage compartment section. What this report says is there is a possibility that Madeleine McCann's DNA is present in this mixture.
Now, what's said in that interview could radically alter the direction of this case. It could also help answer the key question. How does a little girl vanish off the face of the earth, never to be seen again? And that's what this podcast is really all about. More than a decade on, an innocent girl is still missing. And having researched this case for over 2 years since that night, reading and rereading the evidence, having spoken to detectives, law enforcement officials, deception experts, forensic pathologists, cell phone data experts, criminal profilers, and a number of people close to the investigation, including a private detective hired by the McCanns, as you'll hear, not everything has been done to find Madeleine. And in some instances, some of the decisions made by those involved almost appear to have had the opposite effect.
It was almost like, we're not going to look at every potential answer to this. This was, in some respects, from an investigator's perspective, quite a narrow remit.
That's Graham Whetton, a former copper with London's Met Police. You'll hear more from him later. The intrigue and murkiness of Maddie's disappearance has captivated people around the world. From the moment Jerry and Kate McCann spoke outside their holiday apartment, about 24 hours after Maddie was reported missing, the world was hooked. This would be one of the biggest news stories of the decade.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter Madeleine. We request that anyone who may have any information related to Madeleine's disappearance, no matter how trivial, contact the Portuguese police and help us get her back safely. Please, if you have Madeleine, let her come home to her mummy, daddy, brother and sister.
What we know is this. More than a decade on, despite an international police effort and tens of millions of dollars spent investigating a ghoulish crime, Maddie is still missing. If an abductor spied on the McCanns, it's vital you and I understand the patterns that the family of five followed on their holiday. So let's go back to the very beginning, to the start of a holiday that would forever change the lives of so many people and end with the tragedy of Maddie going missing. On April 28, 2007, Kate and Jerry McCann flew into Portugal from England and checked into the Ocean Club Resort in Praia da Luz, a sleepy seaside village on the Algarve. The Algarve sits on Portugal's most southwestern corner, and it's especially popular with British holidaymakers. Kate was 39 and Jerry 38. They were a good-looking couple, and they were travelling with their three young children. Eldest daughter, Madeleine Beth McCann. She was almost four, and her younger twin brother and sister, Sean and Emily, who were both aged 2 years, 3 months. The McCanns lived in Routhley, Leicestershire, and they were on a group holiday with seven British friends, who had become infamously known as the Tapas Seven. Like the McCanns, some couples in that group also had young children with them. During the original Portuguese 14-month investigation into Maddie's disappearance, some of the Tapas Seven would end up with a higher profile than others. That was either because of what they did on the evening of May 3, because of what they claimed to have seen on the night of May 3, or because of what they said in statements that they later gave to police. What I'm going to do now is run through each of the Tapas Seven. It's really vital to understand who's who in this story. So to make things extra clear, I'll also flag who in the Tapas Seven that you need to pay particular attention to. Now, the group's trip had been organized by a man called David Payne. Like Kate and Jerry, David Payne, who was aged 41, he was also a doctor, and so was David's wife, Fiona Payne. She was 34. The Paynes were on holiday with their two small daughters, both aged under three. Fiona's mother, Diane Webster, had also traveled with the family, and she was staying with them in the same apartment. Now, David's important, and here's why. Outside of Kate and Jerry McCann, David, a balding man who wore glasses, he was the last person to see Maddie alive in the early evening of May 3, according to the version of events that were given to police. The next couple are Russell O'Brien and Jane Tanner. Russell was 36, and he was also another doctor colleague of Jerry McCann. Russell and Jane had two girls, also both under the age of 3. Jane Tanner was a dark-haired 37-year-old marketing manager. Jane is a crucial figure in the investigation. On the night Maddie vanished, Jane claimed to have seen a man hurriedly carrying a small child away from the direction of the McCann's apartment. It was a potentially vital sighting, but police had concerns over the reliability of her information and her statements. They came under intense scrutiny. Finally, we have Matthew Oldfield, aged 37, yet another doctor, and his wife, Rachel. Rachel was 36, a former lawyer turned recruitment consultant. The couple were travelling with their 18-month-old baby. Matt Oldfield is another significant person in all of this, and here's why. Matt said he entered the McCann apartment at about 9:30 p.m. on the night Maddie disappeared, which must have been very close to the point that the alleged abduction took place. The group of 9 adults and 8 children were all set to stay 7 nights at the family-friendly Ocean Club Resort. The hotel was attractive to families. It offered childcare packages, and adults could take part in activities such as tennis and water sports. So the McCanns and their friends were all booked into the same white 5-story building. The building was largely a combination of 1- and 2-bedroom apartments. Many had balconies and patios. The McCanns were given the keys to apartment 5A. Now, apartment 5A is a 2-bedroom unit which sits at the very end of the block. It's nestled into the corner of a T-junction which connects 2 small roads. To get a better understanding of this layout, visit 9.com.au/Maddie to see a graphic showing where everyone stayed. The Ocean Club Resort looked perfect for the McCanns and their friends. During the day, the kids would go to the resort's creche, where they would be looked after by nannies and childcare workers. And that would allow Kate and Jerry, who were a fit and active couple, and their friends, time to relax, play tennis, go for runs, or take advantage of the water sports. But there was one problem at the resort: dining options. The Ocean Club Resort was spread over several main hubs, with local housing peppered in between. The Ocean Club's Millennium Restaurant was about a 10-minute walk from the McCann's apartment. On their first night in Praia Deluge, the McCann's ate at the Millennium. But with 3 young kids, the 650-metre dinnertime walk, well, it was laborious, and the McCann's had not packed a pram for their holiday. Together, the group decided that the Ocean Club's other restaurant, the Tapas Restaurant, which was less than 100 metres away from their apartments, that was the best dinner option. It was much closer, no more trudging the road with tired kids. And so, from the second night until Maddie vanished, Kate, Jerry and their friends would eat at the much more handily located Tapas Bar. The group also made another joint decision. They told police that despite the resort offering a nighttime creche between the hours of 7:30 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. at a cost of just £10 an hour, everyone decided that they would leave the kids alone in their respective apartments. Together, they'd share the duty of checking on the children every half hour or so. In Kate's 2011 book, which was titled Madeline, she explained why they didn't use the nighttime babysitting service. Maddie, Sean and Emily would go to bed around 7:15 p.m. So Kate said taking the kids to the creche at 7:30 p.m. and then bringing them home after the adults had finished their late evening meal, well, that would disrupt the kids' sleeping habits. Besides, it was still low season and the complex was pretty quiet. Kate and Jerry would always say the arrangement felt safe, as Kate says in this 2007 interview on Sky News.
The restaurant where we were eating is on the complex where we're staying. It's quite similar to on a summer's evening at home, eating in your garden while the children are in your bed. You know, it's that close.
And here's Jerry, also on Sky News, but in an interview several months later.
I think, you know, with the way we've talked about it before, it felt very similar to dining in your garden.
So, the plan was, at about 5:30 p.m. each day, the nannies at the creche would bring Maddie, Sean and Emily to a dining area close to the tapas bar. There, they'd reunite with Kate and Jerry, and the kids would eat a high tea each night. After that, the usual evening routine would kick in. The kids would be taken home, they'd bath, relax, enjoy a little quiet playtime, and then they'd get put to bed. At around 8:30 each evening, with the kids tucked up in bed, the parents would meet at the tapas bar for their evening meal and drinks. Now, aside from David and Fiona Payne, who had a high-tech baby monitor, which allowed them to listen to their children all the way across in the tapas bar, Kate, Jerry and the other parents ran a checking system. Every 30 minutes or so, someone would go and check the kids to make sure they were settled and sleeping. As you can imagine, there was a tremendous public debate when details of this checking system emerged and the claims that a group of doctors were leaving their children alone each night. I wanted to put aside my own judgments on this issue, and I've asked a lot of people about it. Was it okay to leave kids alone, like the McCanns did? The vast majority of people I spoke to were opposed to the idea of leaving kids alone. Their responses were immediate, almost instinctive, an instant no. But then again, who was really going to admit to me, a reporter holding a microphone, that they have done it, or would consider doing it? But do you know what? One woman, a British mother, she did. She bravely confided in me that considering the relative close proximity of 5A to the tapas bar, she would have done just what the McCanns did.
If it was 80 metres, I might have done. But I don't know if I would have been able to relax. My biggest fear about leaving my kids actually would have been a fire breaking out or something like that, as opposed to abduction. And, you know, so I would always tend to anticipate some kind of disaster, but that wouldn't have been the one. But I can understand the comfort and security they felt in doing that 80 metres away. But it's a false comfort, clearly.
The other interesting thing about this case is the more I speak to people about it, the more they begin to remember. May 2007. That's a long time ago. That's a lot of dust to shake off. But before we blow that dust off and we look at what happened, some words of advice from a man who solved 30-plus murders, retired homicide detective Colin Sutton.
If you are looking to review something, then I think you have to do it with a completely open mind, and you start at the beginning and you look at what's gone on and the statements that were taken and the accounts that were given, and you compare them and you kind of try to find the inconsistencies, and you try and find, you know, a way through that shows you what actually happened. My instinct is always to look at things with a view that you know, the simple explanation is probably going to be the most likely one. You know, somebody knows, or some people know what the truth is.
So let's rewind a little and go back to the morning of May 3, the day Madeline was reported missing. As was the pattern now, the McCanns put Maddie, Sean and Emily into the daycare centre around 9 a.m. Then, at 12:30, they collected all three kids and returned to apartment 5A for lunch. After lunch, the McCann family went to the resort swimming pool, and this is where the famous last photo of Maddie was taken. In the photo, Maddie is wearing a peach smock, white shorts and a white sun hat. She's sitting with her father, Jerry, and her sister, Emily. She has a huge smile on her face. Madeline and her family hung out here until about 3 p.m., according to Kate and Jerry's police statements. I just want to underline, everything I'm recounting here is based on police statements. After sitting by the pool, the kids were then walked back to the creche. Kate and Jerry then spent the late afternoon playing tennis against each other. Kate also went for a jog, and then around 5 p.m, the creche nannies brought Maddie and the twins to the tapas area, where the kids ate their dinner. Now, according to police statements, this would be the last time anyone else sees Maddie alive, outside of the McCann family and anyone else in the Tapas 7. That person is Katrina Baker, a young British woman who was Maddie's assigned nanny at the creche. At about 5:40 p.m., Kate and Jerry took the kids back to apartment 5A. This was a little earlier than their usual routine. Kate put this down to the kids being especially tired. During police investigations, detectives are always looking for changes to routines. It may mean something, it may mean nothing, but changes in routine are always noted. Once home, Maddie, Sean and Emily are all bathed and changed into their pajamas. Jerry is only there briefly before he returns to the courts to continue playing tennis. At about 6:30 p.m., now back down at the tennis courts, Jerry asks his friend, David Payne, to go up to 5A and check on Kate and the kids. Remember I said David Payne was important? The reason given for David's visit was that all the group's kids were going to get together for a quick playtime in a recreation area before bed. Jerry said he sent David up to 5A to see if Kate needed help getting the kids there. There's some discrepancy over how long David Payne spent at the apartment. Kate said David Payne stayed about 30 seconds, returning to Jerry at the tennis courts between 6:30 and 6:40 p.m. However, Jerry said David stayed longer and did not return until 7 p.m. It's a small, perhaps inconsequential difference, but it is a difference of almost 30 minutes nonetheless, and it does come at a critical juncture. According to the group's police statements, David is the very last person to see Madeline alive other than Kate and Jerry. Now, in her book and statements that Kate gave to police, she makes repeated references to how tired Maddie is on May 3. And it's because Maddie is so tired, Kate says, that she has a change of mind. She decides not to take the kids to that group playdate with the other families. Instead, she stays home. Again, another small change to the routine. Here, appearing on Irish TV channel RTE for The Late Late Show, Kate describes this part of the evening, when she is alone with Maddie and the twins.
I just sat down on the couch with the three kids and had some treats and biscuits and crisps and stuff. And she sat on my lap and just cuddled in. And she often liked to put my engagement ring on. So she had that on her finger, and then we read a story, and it was lovely.
After finishing his tennis match, Jerry returns to 5A at around 7 p.m. Inside, he finds Kate and the kids all playing on the sofa. 15 minutes later, at 7:15 p.m., Kate leads the kids into their bedroom. Now, the McCann's apartment is probably the most exposed unit in the entire five-story building. The outside of the children's bedroom, including the window, is impossible to see from the tapas bar. If you can try and visualize the room, Maddie is put into a single bed nearest the bedroom door. If you stood at the bedroom door, Maddie's bed is to your left. It's a small room. Straight ahead of you is an empty spare single bed against the opposite wall, partially beneath the window. That window will become hugely significant and controversial. Between you and the window are two travel cots for the twins, Sean and Emily. To see a layout of apartment 5A, go to 9.com.au/Maddie. Kate then reads the kids another story, with all four of them sitting on Maddie's bed. Sean and Emily then kiss Maddie goodnight. Kate and Jerry each put a twin in their crib. Kate and Jerry then kiss Maddie goodnight. It is now 7:30 p.m. Over the next hour, Jerry takes a bath and he and Kate change outfits. They open a bottle of New Zealand white wine and have a couple of drinks, and then they head to the tapas restaurant. At 8:35 p.m, Kate and Jerry are the first of their holiday group to arrive. In dribs and drabs, the other couples from the Tapas 7 turn up. And so begins the checking of the children. The checking system is absolutely pivotal to the Maddie mystery. Now's a really good moment to introduce a man called Peter McLeod. Peter is a retired English police officer. After 28 years with the Nottingham Police, Peter rose to the rank of superintendent. He now lives in Spain. Peter has spent time in the town of Praia da Luz, and he's researched this case extensively. I asked Peter to describe the walk from the tapas bar to apartment 5A. He describes walking to the sliding door on the McCann's back patio, and he also describes the longer route to the front door. Now, the sloping road that Peter talks about is also really important. It's a significant location in the 60 minutes leading up to Maddie's reported disappearance.
One of the first things we did was go to the tapas bar and have a look around, and then just sort of pace it out at a normal walking pace. And you come out of the tapas bar, you then go towards the pool and then to the right, and there's what they call a reception area. And then you come out onto the road and you turn left and walk up the road. And it is a slope. When I say up the road, I do mean up a slope. And at exactly 1 minute, or 59 seconds to be precise, you end up at that little metal gate. If you go through the metal gate, you then have to go up the stairs onto the balcony, onto the patio, and then through the sliding patio doors. If you carry on up the road, you then come to the T-junction at the top. You turn left, walk along, and then come into the car park, go across the car park, and then you come to the front door. Now, that takes you another minute. So the whole going around to the front door takes 2 minutes, and going to the side door takes just one.
Aside from getting a sense of that walk, I think what Peter's description shows is that dining at the tapas bar, it wasn't really like dining in your back garden with the kids sleeping in the house, as Kate and Jerry would often compare this to. Anyway, stick with me, because I'm now going to break down who moved where in the last 60 minutes before Kate alerted everyone that Maddie was missing. There's a lot of moving parts here. People getting up and down from the table, going into rooms, checking on children. But I can't stress enough, this part of the night is so critical to get an understanding of what might have happened to Madeline McCann. According to the group's police statements, this is what transpired next. At 8:55 p.m., Matthew Oldfield goes to check his baby in apartment 5B. His apartment is next door to the McCanns. On his check, Matt Oldfield said on the way to his front door, he listened outside the bedroom window of 5A, where Maddie and the twins were sleeping. All was quiet. Matt Oldfield also goes up to the Paynes' apartment on the first floor. Paynes are still inside at this point. They're running late for dinner. Matt gives them a gentle hurry up to join the others at the restaurant. Next up is Jerry McCann at 9:05 p.m. He goes back to 5A, but the route he says he takes changes in two statements he would later give police. Is it a crucial change? Perhaps it's nothing, but I'll be looking at this inconsistency and why it may or may not matter in episode 2. Jerry pokes his head into the kids' bedroom, and here, during an interview with Oprah Winfrey, he describes what he says will be the final time he ever sees Madeline.
I actually stepped into the room and the twins were sound asleep and Madeline was lying in her bed exactly where she was when I left, cuddle cat up beside her head in her blanket.
And Jerry describes that moment in more detail here in this interview on Swedish TV show Skavlan.
It's terrible. I've said this a few times, but I had one of those poignant moments as a parent where I went into a room and the door was open and I just paused for a second and I looked and she was sound asleep and I thought how beautiful she was. The twins were asleep in their cots and I thought how lucky we were. And within, you know, minutes, that was shattered.
After checking the kids, Jerry uses the toilet and he leaves 5A. On his way back to the restaurant, around 9:10 p.m., on the narrow sloping road described by ex-cop Peter McLeod, he bumps into a British man called Jeremy Wilkins. Jeremy Wilkins is out walking his young child. The two British holidaymakers, who have seen each other around the Ocean Club resort, they chat for several minutes. Right about now, Jane Tanner leaves the group table at the tapas bar. Her version of events will prove absolutely critical, particularly who and what she claims to see on this walk. Jane Tanner later tells police that she sees Jerry and Jeremy Wilkins on the sloping road and that she walks right past them at about 9:10 p.m. However, despite how quiet and narrow that sloping road is, neither Jerry nor Jeremy Wilkins sees Jane Tanner. Walking up this road, Jane Tanner also sees something else. In the darkness, from some distance, Jane Tanner will later say she saw a man carrying a child across the T-junction road ahead, away from the direction of Maddie's bedroom window. Again, neither Jerry nor Jeremy Wilkins sees this man with a child. We have video and graphics to show just how narrow that key road is at 9.com.au/Maddie. Jane Tanner and the evidence she gives police is one of the case's most important and controversial interventions. Her sighting reinforces the abduction theory, and it also proves pivotal in terms of setting the early focus and direction of the police investigation. The Tanner sighting also places Jerry on the road at a key moment. After her short walk, Jane returns to the tapas bar. At 9:30 p.m., Kate McCann prepares to check on Maddie and the twins. But at the same time, Matthew Oldfield and Russell O'Brien, they both get up. They are about to check on their own children. It's worth noting that Jane Tanner, who is Russell O'Brien's partner, she's probably only got back from her check 15 minutes ago. Yet, despite that small interval, Russell O'Brien goes to check on their daughter. He and Jane later tell police that their baby was sick. Matthew Oldfield tells Kate to stay at the table. He offers to check on Maddie and the twins. Kate agrees and sits back down. But unlike the check Matt Oldfield made at 8:55 p.m., where he listened outside Maddie's bedroom window, this time he enters 5A. Matt Oldfield enters 5A through the unlocked backsliding door. Matt tells police that once inside, he only stands at Maddie's bedroom doorway. From there, he sees the twins, both sleeping. But he tells police he doesn't see Maddie, because her bed is not visible from the doorway. It's tucked around to the left. Convinced everything is fine, Matt Oldfield returns to the tapas bar. At 10 p.m, Kate McCann gets up from the table to go check on Maddie and the twins. What follows is the nightmare Kate walked into. She breaks down what happened in a 2012 interview with Swedish TV show Skavlan.
Well, it was 10 o'clock when I went to check on Madeline, and I walked into the sitting room of the apartment, and I noticed that the children's bedroom door was open further than we'd left it. We always close it quite far over, but just enough so some light gets in, and it's quite open. And it was our friend Matt who had checked on the children at 9:30 when he was checking on his daughter next door. And I thought to myself, well, maybe Matt's left the door open when he's checked on them. So I walked over to the bedroom door and I was about to close it too again. And as I did that, it kind of slammed shut. And I thought, oh, there must be a draft. And I checked the door behind me and I hadn't left that open. And then I opened the door again of the children's bedroom just to leave it open a little bit. And that's when I really looked in. And I couldn't quite make out Madeline in a bed. And I just looked and looked. And it was obviously quite dark. And it must be a parental thing where you don't switch a light on. She worried about waking them. But then I realised she wasn't actually there. And I thought, well, she must have wandered through to our bedroom. And maybe that would explain why the door was open. So I went into our bedroom and she wasn't there. And that was the first time really that the panic hit. And I just ran back into her bedroom. And literally at that point, the curtains, which were closed, just kind of flew open. And that was when I noticed that the window was open as far as it could go. And the shutters outside had been raised all the way up. And I just knew straight away that someone had taken her.
A bombshell Maddie is gone. Kate runs from the apartment towards Jerry and the others at the tapas bar. Witnesses say they heard her screaming things, like they've taken her and we've let her down. A frantic search begins. Perhaps it was the panic, but police would later wonder why Kate ran from 5A, leaving the twins alone in the apartment. She had, after all, just discovered Maddie was missing, taken, as she said, by an intruder. In the next episode of Maddie...
It's very obvious that the shutters were not damaged or smashed or forced or jammed. And it was at that point I thought, this is very, very strange.
The police begin their work, two pieces of evidence in particular, Maddie's open bedroom window and the Jane Tanner sighting. They strongly drive a theory that Maddie was abducted. But under close scrutiny, is that crucial evidence reliable? And is there any evidence supporting allegations that the crime scene appeared staged? The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.